Good evening, listeners, brave navigators of the enigmatic and the concealed. Have you ever felt the pull of the unanswered, the allure of the mysteries that shroud our existence? For more than a decade, a unique comic publisher has dared to dive into these mysteries, unafraid of the secrets they might uncover. This audacious entity is Paranoid American. Welcome to the mystifying universe of the Paranoid American podcast.
Launched in the year 2012, Paranoid American has been on a mission to decipher the encrypted secrets of our world. From the unnerving enigma of MKUltra mind control to the clandestine assemblies of secret societies. From the awe-inspiring frontiers of forbidden technology to the arcane patterns of occult symbols in our very own pop culture. They have committed to unveiling the concealed realities that lie just beneath the surface. Join us as we navigate these intricate landscapes, decoding the hidden scripts of our society and challenging the accepted perceptions of reality.
Folks, I've got a big problem on my hands. There's a company called Paranoid American making all these funny memes and comics. Now, I'm a fair guy. I believe in free speech, as long as it doesn't cross the line. And if these AI-generated memes dare to make fun of me, they're crossing the line.
This is your expedition into the realm of the extraordinary, the secret, the shrouded. Come with us as we sift through the world's grand mysteries, question the standardized narratives, and brave the cryptic labyrinth of the concealed truth. So strap yourselves in, broaden your horizons, and steel yourselves for a voyage into the enigmatic heart of the Paranoid American podcast, where each story, every image, every revelation brings us one step closer to the elusive truth.
Welcome to another episode of Paranoid American Podcast, and I'm incredibly excited today because I've got an all-around badass joining us. This is Mark Rogers. He's up there front and center. First of all, before we even get into anything else, can you just do some plugs up front and tell people where they can go and find your work, what your social medias are, like all that?
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks for having me. Website is www.markrogersart.com, and my social media is at Mark Rogers Art.
So, Mark, I came across your artwork probably on Instagram like a while ago, and it was probably just like a passing thing. I was like, oh, cool, there's like an Indian cow or an alien cowboy or something, you know, like it had like a certain aesthetic to it. And then I saw another one, and I realized that you had really honed into this very particular aesthetic and topic and just like content matter. And I don't know, like I felt like maybe you knew who I was and you were like secretly making all this artwork just for my enjoyment, because it was like so dead on to everything that I love about, I guess, like traditional like folk art, but also conspiracy theories. Like we got dolphins and aliens and reptilians. And so first, I just want to ask you, do you have like a name for your aesthetic or your style or anything?
No, I don't really think I have a name for it, but all my paintings do take place in a fantasy world that I call the Southwestern Bellows, that kind of exists in my sketchbooks and my imagination. And a lot of it is set like in the Southwest in a, it's kind of like if you were to think about like a fantasy novel, it's like set in Europe. It's like, you know, in the medieval ages. This one is, and it's got elves and stuff. My weird fantasy world I paint in is kind of like the American version of that, but it's set in the 1800s and it has aliens and shit like that instead of elves. So that's kind of what I do.
And did this place start in your mind and you were like, I have to paint this place? Or did you start painting and determine like I'm going to world build? Like how did it actually start?
Yeah, a little bit of both. Before I was a painter, I really wanted to become a writer like Stephen King. I love Stephen King so much. I don't read just like horror and stuff, though. I read a lot of fantasy novels. I love world building. I'm kind of a nerd like that. But yeah, when I started painting, you know, that interest really, I don't know, took a center stage, I guess. And yeah, and I've always been interested in paranormal topics and stuff like that too. So like all my interests kind of combined. It's like, what are you going to paint? I don't know. I mean, just stuff you're into. And that's like stuff I think is interesting. So.
And here, I'm going to just have some of your art up on the screen while we talk a little bit, just so that some of the viewers can kind of see some of these aesthetics. And I'm not going to make you explain all these in detail or anything, but like some of these bring some really cool ideas to mind. So this is the Crystal Mountain Invaders, and this is in two parts. And I assume this is happening under this dude's house. And they've each got a portal. Like, where are these portals going? Are these going back to like their alien world, or is this another place on our world?
Well, that painting is pretty old. So that one's 2016. I'm trying to think of what was going through my mind at the time, but I was kind of thinking that maybe that was the basement. And that the alien was going through the portal and entering into the that miner's cabin.
And we got Nephilim too, which I've never seen a depiction quite like this of Nephilim, where he's holding like a giant nautilus, I guess.
Yeah.
So outside of this particular piece, what are your thoughts on Nephilim in general? Like, are you big into the topic? Do you think that it's real? Do you think they actually existed at some point?
I don't really have any concrete ideas on, you know, I don't have any firm beliefs on any of this stuff. I'm totally open-minded though, and I'm totally interested in reading as much and, you know, absorbing as much of this kind of content as I can, because it's all super fascinating. But I mean, I've never seen evidence of like giant like angel creatures personally, but you know, I mean, you know, on the internet you can find anything to confirm your bias one way or another, but I'm just like totally open and fascinated with all these topics. So I mean, I can't really you know, say whether or not I'm interested or I have like a firm belief in it, but I was raised Catholic. And I think that that's where I first started. I'm not Catholic now, for the record, but I think that's where some of my interest in some of these topics came in, you know, just like magic and, you know, people coming back from the dead and like, you know, stuff that sounds like alien stuff.
Catholic mass is feels very high magic. Like it's a lot of,
it's ritual magic.
Like, yeah. Oh yeah. Big time. And this one is, I'm curious, how long did something like this take you for like a piece like this one as an example?
That one, I'm going to say like 3 weeks, I guess.
So does this mean
about like four or five hours a day, usually?
I mean, it's a substantial amount of time. So
yeah,
for 3 weeks, were you thinking about Nephilim constantly, or does this just leave the second you leave the canvas?
It actually leaves before I even get there. Like usually it'll like take place in my sketchbook, so I'll usually draw something out there. Like the way I've been working now is I've been working in like series of 9 paintings, so I'll actually like put together a storyboard and then I'll just go through and paint them one at a time. But I'm always like 9 paintings ahead of the painting I'm painting. So like right now I'm thinking about one series, but I'm painting one that I drew up a while ago. So I guess I'm not necessarily like thinking about them anymore. Like the story's been kind of written, but I'm just like revisiting them and trying to come up with extra details I can like pack into the painting and stuff. But really all the conceptual stuff just kind of happens in the sketchbook, almost like a year before I paint the painting.
Interesting. That reminds me kind of like working on comics, where like I'll get a hair up my ass about a certain story and I'll write it all out and I'll figure out like what the art's going to look like and get all the character sketches and it feels like, okay. And it's almost like I never learn after, you know, decades. I feel like if I get all this energy and I put all that effort in, then like I'll wake up the next morning and it'll just like be done and be there. But really it goes into the production process. And yeah, I can relate to where like you stop putting everything into that story because it's like already out on the assembly line and you're just waiting to see how it gets produced and then maybe tweak it a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really a process like that. I enjoy it. A lot though. I like the, I don't know. I just like the rhythm of just waking up and painting and just working on it like marathon style. It's just like, you just kind of keep going. And, yeah, it's not just like this wild thing, like, whoa, man, I just thought about, you know, like a man turning into from a Sasquatch into a man and he's not wearing any shoes. I'm just so pumped about it. I'm going to do it now. You know, it's like it takes like months and like maybe a year later I'll start painting that weird idea that came into my head. So
do you run into like a like writer's block or artist block for any of this, or do you just push yourself and power through it?
I just kind of power through it slowly.
You got any tips for anyone that hits creative blocks and doesn't know how to just power through it?
Yeah, I have a couple, strategies that I do, for, one thing that I do for, like an artist block, like trying to figure out a composition or trying to figure out something like that is I do these, 10 minute thumbnail things, where I'll just draw out like a little, like my rectangle where the painting might go, and I'll just put on a timer and I'll just try to fill that up in 10 minutes and then I'll just move on and go 10 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes. And that's like a strategy that will usually yield some sort of a composition. And then limiting all the possibilities is like another thing that really helps me creatively, because you can really like paint or draw like anything. So coming up with like a limited range of what you're going to be working on, you can be creative, pretty creative in a, when you have some constraints there, you know, like if you're painting from a storyboard or something, you're like, okay, I've got these characters, you know, I've got this situation. I find it really helpful to work like that. And I actually do the same thing with like, weirdly, my painting palette. Like I only buy 6 tubes of paint and I've been using the same exact colors since I started like in 2009, I guess.
That's are there any, I mean, I don't know how else to ask this question. It might sound ignorant question, but are there like any colors that you're still discovering that you can make out of those 6 different like root colors, or have you pretty much found the whole spectrum at this point?
I think I found the whole spectrum of those colors, I think. I have been really thinking about switching my red out for a different red because I use primary colors. I use primary colors, a black and a white and a brown. And those are the colors that I use. But yeah, I think I've been able to figure out every single combination that I can get with those specific colors. But yeah, I still feel like I'm learning though, and I'm still trying to get better.
You had a note on this one painting where you said, I enjoy painting alien languages because humans rarely notice my dyslexic spelling errors.
Yeah, I'm dyslexic.
So how do you think that affected you communicating through art? Was that like a... I don't know, like for a lot of people that I know that were dyslexic that then became artists were like, it was the first time that they felt they could communicate without thinking that they were making mistakes or having to like check every little thing.
Yeah. Let me think about this. Well, I feel as if my dyslexia really shows up when I'm talking out loud and when I'm reading stuff, I'll just mix up the words and mix them backwards. Like not when I'm reading, just reading a book, like I'm a pretty voracious reader, but when I'm reading the text in the book out loud to somebody, it's very obvious. I once got fired from a record store for, you know, my inability to organize records by with the human alphabet. I thought I was doing it right, but you know, there's something that switches in my brain that I guess I wasn't doing a very good job. But I don't know. I think I'm an okay writer, but yeah, telling stories with pictures is way, it seems way more natural to me.
This one too, this was probably one of my favorite ones. And the description, I mean, I saw it before I read the description. I was wondering, like, is this a guy turning into an alien, or was this an alien taking off his suit? And sure enough, this is a depiction of his Zeta Reticuli Gray removing the living Homo sapien costume in a physically and spiritually exhaustive process known as drama. So is this something that, like, you had like a dream about or thought up? Like how much of this machine do you know how it works, or is this just an aesthetic thing?
I have no idea. It just started happening. I can't really tell you. Like, I kind of got an idea, and I just,
so there's no patent like on this thing.
This one's an earlier, painting as well. I'm like gonna get close. Yeah. 2017. I guess it's not that early, but, that one isn't part of like a major storyline or anything, but I was like, just, I think I had seen early, I really like just collecting reference material from like the 1800s and stuff. And I think I had seen some reference material with some photography in it, and people getting photography, you know, having their photo taken or early experiments with photography. And then my brain just went with that instead of a camera. And then I, you know, so I was kind of thinking about 1800s photography when I came up with that. But that's how an alien like takes off its human face, the dissimulation reversal. Yeah, and my cat is actually, that cat in that painting is actually sitting right here beside me while I do this interview.
This is a 20 pound cat.
He's lost a lot of weight. I think he's only like, I don't know, he might be only 11 pounds or something, but he,
he's half the cat.
Yeah. I used to live in a studio apartment for many years. And then, and I live in a house now, and the house has stairs. So he runs up and down the stairs. I think it's good for him.
Did you find yourself gravitate towards like an area in like the Midwest or like in the West, like your paintings follow? Like, are you in Arizona or something? Or
I'm originally from Portland, Oregon, and my parents were born in Arizona. So all of my extended family lives in Arizona. And then my biological father lives in Palm Springs, California, like, which is right next to Joshua Tree. So I visit him quite often. So I'll go down to the desert and do that. But I could never personally live in the desert because I'm very pale and the sun destroys me. But yeah, I used to live in Portland. And then a little over a year ago, I moved to the Midwest. I live in Fort Wayne, Indiana now. I moved here because I was like, well, Portland was getting a little expensive for housing, and I really wanted to buy a house, and I couldn't afford one there. But I was like, I think I can afford one in the Midwest somewhere. I'd never even heard of Fort Wayne, but I started just doing some research, and I was like, okay, Fort Wayne, it's a little smaller, but it's outside of Chicago. It's outside of Indianapolis and Detroit. It's kind of like right in the middle. So, yeah, and the weather isn't super brutal as far as snow goes. I mean, we get snow, but it's not like Milwaukee or Buffalo or someplace. Those were some of the other places I was thinking about. So,
have you done any pieces with snow?
I've drawn stuff in my sketchbook with snow while I was in Milwaukee in the snow. But no, I've never painted a snow piece yet. I
We
will,
got
though,
yeah,
eventually.
there's a Christmas series coming up, or
Yeah, I'll do a
winter
Christmas
series.
series. Yeah, I'll do a Christmas series.
You mentioned too that you really like looking for reference material and stuff from the 1800s. Is this like, I mean, I'll assume just, browsing online and looking around, but like if you're driving by an old pawn shop or you're walking around a pawn shop, is there something that you're like always keeping your eye open for, like a certain magazine or a certain like tin or
No, but I love visiting history museums. I guess that's my thing. It's like whenever I go to a new city, I'm like, I want to visit the history museum. Sometimes I'll take photos, reference photos of the things they have there. Like as soon as I moved to Fort Wayne, like I was like, I'm going to the history museum. I'm going to learn about this place. That's also fun, to like kind of learning about different places. But I also visually like I love stuff from that time period. Just like before computers, before really like the Industrial Revolution took off. It's just like weird to think about how people lived their lives and did stuff with,
No Game Boy.
with that kind of no Game Boy. Yeah.
I can't. I wouldn't want to live in that time period. The Game Boy
Me
got me
neither.
through rough times.
Yeah, having surgery or something back then, whoa, that'd
Yeah,
be brutal.
you're bite down on this cloth if you were lucky.
Yeah, I mean, even just like going to the bathroom, like having to use an outhouse, just like everything, it's hard. Everything's just hard.
It sounds like something that you would like pay to experience only so that you can like go back to normal life afterwards, like these days.
Well, I did experience it in the form of the Johnny Appleseed festival, which happened here in Fort Wayne just a couple weeks ago. I love going to yeah, any like historical reenactment thing. I like watching it from the sidelines and being like, wow, that's really
What was the
interesting.
highlight from the Johnny Appleseed thing?
There were a couple things that stood out. They had like these kids that were they were dressed as like this French drummer group. So they were all playing drum like these snare drums, kind of like marching band style. But what was so weird was like they were just all their faces were just like super deadpan. So they were just like dressed in like these uniforms, like they were time travelers or something, and everybody was watching, and it was just kind of a fun juxtaposition of, like these kids in costume playing drums very seriously, and all these people with their phones out taking pictures of them. That was kind of cool.
What did it have to do with Johnny Appleseed?
Johnny Appleseed is buried in Fort Wayne. So there's just a festival commemorating him and all the trees, all the apple trees he planted. Yeah, the festival happens every year at his gravesite. It's like a big thing out here. It's new for me to be experiencing. I'm like, wow, that's pretty weird and obscure, but it's a real big deal here.
Is it like an apple festival too? They got like apple pie and apple cider and all that, or?
Yeah, we got some apple cider. They have apple pies. They had what's it called? Sarsaparilla root beer. It wasn't very good, or at least the stuff I had. It's not very carbonated. You're used to drinking like soda. Did we have like a LaCroix or whatever, and it's pretty carbonated, but this wasn't. But yeah, it's weirdly
Might have just been
family
flat. They might
friendly
have just
kind of.
dropped it on the ground or
Yeah,
something.
it's totally flat. I don't know what they did back then, if they had any means to carbonate beverages back then, in the 1800s. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, they had
I didn't.
they called them phosphates for a while.
Oh,
And
fascinating.
I think that came, I'm probably just making stuff up as I go here, so people can correct me in the comments, but I could have sworn that the guy that found nitrous oxide also eventually helped contribute to the discovery of like phosphates and fizzy sodas. And I think that was in the late 1700s. So it wouldn't surprise me if someone in the 1800s had some kind of a fizzy drink.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to go down the rabbit hole on that.
And I think beer too. I think they've had carbonated beer for a while. Anyway, I might all just be talking. And I noticed on one of these paintings here, I liked the quote. I think it was this one here. Yeah, it says that the aliens returned in the year 3092 after nuclear radiation has subsided. After meditating hundreds of years with the ancient one, they promised to return to Earth with an extremely chill CBD THC strain, which would not only cure every disease but cure the world. What's the name of that? What's the name of that strain?
Oh man, I have no idea.
Is this like just Northern Lights, or is it something special?
It hasn't been invented yet. That's right. Because it's going to come out a little later, in like 1,000 years from now.
Is this going to be like a Kush? Is it going to be like a sativa?
It's going to be a new blend we've never even heard of.
Fair enough. It'll be that alien strain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then I don't know how much of this is just from like your aesthetic influences and stuff, but I see this and I just kind of read like some kind of Masonic influence a little bit in some ways, at least with like the garb. Or like, are you into any of the ancient mystery schools or secret societies? Does that kind of stuff influence any of your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm super into all of that. I love, magic and witchcraft and
are you in the Illuminati by any chance?
No.
Okay. Would you tell me if you were?
Maybe.
Fair.
I can't. I'm not sure if I can reveal that info.
You can't disclose that.
But yeah, I mean, I love occult stuff. I love magic. I love chaos magic. I'm a Wiccan. I'm like really into all of that. I think it's, I thought about joining the Masons, but I don't think I have enough time.
Yeah, it takes a little while. It's an investment in time for sure.
Yeah, I'm really busy, and I'm kind of like, an introvert. It seems like they hang out a lot, and that's cool, but I'm just so busy.
I mean, there's a lot of different reasons people join them, but I'd like to describe it as like, if you were really into chess, right, you'd join a chess club. And it's not like you could just walk out into public and find someone that likes chess. It's a very niche thing to be interested in. So for me, Masonry is like chess club, but it's for people that like to read like occult books and esoteric topics and old books. And again, very niche thing. And like, you can't just like drive up to like a library and just assume that you're going to bump into someone that cares about like the Ars Goetia or like old 1600s alchemical texts. So that's kind of where Freemasonry stands out, or Rosicrucianism or Othio or any of those.
Mm-hmm.
Have you considered joining any other groups before?
Oh yeah. I've considered joining every one of those groups. But yeah, I'm just not even really, I've just never joined one, but I'm pretty open to it all. There's one that I would join over the others. I don't know. I'm pretty fascinated with the Golden Dawn, but I don't really feel like the Golden Dawn. I don't really know what they're like right now. You know, I only know about the Golden Dawn, in that Victorian era when they were like at the height of their thing. And also, I don't really know if I live near anything like that. So I guess I would join the Masons or like the Odd Fellows or something like that around here.
Yeah, just the geographic really convenience of it, right?
Yeah. Definitely.
So I noticed in one of these back too, it had like a reptilian looking dude. Do you actually believe in greys and reptilians and all these alien entities?
I'm pretty, like I was saying before, I'm pretty open to it all. I don't have any reason to think that it's not real, or I don't really think that I have reason to believe that it is necessarily totally real either. I could go either way. I'm just totally open-minded to the possibility. You know, I love absorbing all of, you know, the books, the stories, the firsthand accounts, like UFOlogy in general has been interesting to me since I was a little tiny kid. I have never personally seen a gray. I've seen a UFO before, but it wasn't like a flying saucer or triangle shaped. But the UFO I saw did look similar to something that I've seen in a couple UFO documentaries, but it was more of like an energy ball shape type of a UFO.
Was it making the like irrational movements and sharp corners and stuff?
It didn't. No, it just flew across the sky pretty low. It was about the size of like a Volkswagen bug or something. And it looked like it was made out of like energy. That's the only way I can really describe it. And it just kind of flew over the horizon line. And I was with another person. We just like kind of watched it. It just flew like above the telephone lines at maybe only like 20 miles an hour. We just kind of watched it cruise by. It didn't have any of like the distinctive stuff that's congruent with like the lore and other people's sightings at all. It was just, you know, it wasn't all spastic. It didn't look like it was capable of, I mean, it didn't even really look like a machine. It just looked like it was made out of magic or something. That's why I still refer to it as a UFO rather than, you know, it was definitely something I could not identify. But that was the only encounter like that I've had that I can think of.
Do you have a lot of UFO enthusiasts reach out to you because of the type of art you produce?
Absolutely. And I love it. I love hearing people's stories. I just think it's so cool. So like, obviously I'm not painting the lore or like the, you know, I feel like there is sort of like a cohesive sort of story that's starting to form with the abduction phenomenon and grays. I feel like that is starting to happen within UFOlogy, but I just have my own like stories that I make up, but still people will recognize that and be like, hey man, can I tell you something that happened to me? And I'm like, please do. So
Just PayPal me $20 and I'll listen to anything.
No, I want to hear, like, people will send me stories like through Instagram. They'll like write their personal stories, or they'll like send me video or like voice recordings and stuff. And I'm always fascinated.
Do you ever go to UFO conventions or anything like that?
No, but I really wanted to go to, there's been a few that I've been tempted to go to. I don't really get out very much, unfortunately, but like there's the Contact in the Desert when I was living on the West Coast, I really wanted to go to, but those tickets are fairly pricey. And then, yeah, do you go to UFO?
I actually just found out that the first annual Orlando UFO convention is happening in like
so a you're week in Orlando.
Yeah, I'm in Orlando.
Okay.
So I haven't been to one. No, I've wanted to, and I might be able to make it to this one. Although if I don't, I'll be bummed. But I absolutely am going to go to all the future ones. I just found out about it too late. Desert UFO, like. Didn't you want to go and do the Naruto run into Area 51?
No.
No, okay, yeah, me either. It just seemed a little hot.
Yeah, I'm just a painter. I don't have, like, you know, I don't have expertise or, like, hidden knowledge that other people don't have. You know, I just like
you can keep that tight lip, though. You don't have to say that out loud. You can be like, oh, no, I've got all the secrets.
Yeah, I don't have any secrets that you know of. But I actually just remembered I did go to the McMinnville UFO Festival. Sorry, it took a second for my brain to catch up. But there was a sighting.
The side effect of that, that Men in Black flash that they gave you on the way out.
Yeah. McMinnville, in McMinnville, Oregon, they had a pretty significant sighting in, like, I think it was the 50s, standard flying saucer type UFO. Anybody can just Google McMinnville UFO. And so every year they have a festival there that has been, it'll probably just pop up right away. There it is. Yeah, they have a little festival there. They had like a pet parade where people dress up their dogs.
A little and like, chicken, like robot
chickens
outfits.
Like aliens. Yeah.
And chickens.
Yeah, it's a little country out.
That's awesome.
Outside of Oregon or outside of Portland in the smaller cities.
Oh, I'm sure it exists. I guess I just never considered that there might be like a best in show chicken edition.
Yeah, I saw a green chicken out there.
Like naturally green or dyed green?
Dyed. Yeah. Okay. I was like, is that really very good for the animal? But I don't know.
That's where Tyson gets all of their chicken from.
Chickens.
This might sound a little bit random and you might even have an answer, but I'm just, do you have an idea in mind, like the physics of what's going on here? Is she is she enclosed in like energy prism, or is this like a material prism? Like, what's going on here?
She's generating an energy prism around her body because she has just discovered that she has that ability. So she is kind of showing her parents what she can do. She's like, this is what I can do. That one had a flash and tattooed. So like after you get tattooed, you're all like kind of spacey or whatever. And I had my sketchbook with me and I was just like sitting down afterwards and I was just like kind of spacing out. And I just drew that lady inside of that. So I don't know. I just had a story of just like really quickly flash into my mind and I just drew it in my sketchbook real fast and then painted it like a year later. But
are those fleeting? Like if you hadn't sketched it at that exact moment and waited until you got home, like would it have just dissipated?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I think they do kind of stick with me. Yeah, I've been, I have this current idea I've been working on. I think I've drawn like, I don't know, it's just like in my mind, but I've drawn so many different like little thumbnails and the same one's been in my mind for months now. So.
Are you waiting for your brain to just say like, that's the one? Like,
Yeah, pretty much. I have specific drawing times during the day, you know, so I'll like, right now I draw first thing in the morning. So I'll just wake up with my cup of coffee and I'll just like start sketching and, I do that for like 45 minutes or an hour. And if I get it, I get it. If I don't, I'll maybe get it tomorrow or the next day or whatever.
I love the perspective of some of these ones here.
That one's a really tiny painting. I almost forgot I painted that.
What kind of paintings don't make it onto your website? Like how many are not on the site versus how many are on the site?
I would say a lot of them are on the site. Maybe a lot of my new stuff might not be on the site yet, but I try to be very careful with, or very deliberate, I guess, with, you know, making sure everything is like, you know, I bombed quite a few paintings when I was first starting. So I try to idiot proof my paintings so that I don't make the mistake. I try to make sure like that one, I might want to take that one off my website now.
Really? What are you seeing in it that makes you think that?
I think that I am probably better at painting. I don't like how I rendered that girl's face. I think that, I would have rendered some of the things differently, but I'm a little older now and I've been doing it for a little longer. And that probably happens with every artist, You're like, look at your earlier stuff and you cringe a little bit. You're like, dang, I could do that a little bit better.
Yeah. It's one of those things that only you see for sure though. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I guarantee you maybe someone, but I don't think anyone's looking at the canvas and be like, but her face, it could have been rendered different. I mean,
yeah.
Where does the mantis come in? Because mantis isn't something that you would find in Arizona, is it?
No.
Like, is this something from your childhood? Or?
Well, mantids are pretty common in a lot of the UFO lore.
Right.
With grays and stuff where they're where you would like have abduction scenarios where there's like this mantid character that's like almost a different species commingling with the gray characters. In my imagination, I like to think of the mantids as acting as the moral compass for the grays who no longer have the ability to they no longer have the ability to dream. They've traded in their mortality. I call them the Zeta Reticulans because the Betty and Barney Hill incident, Betty said that these aliens told her that they came from the Zeta Reticulan star system. So that's why I always call them the Zeta Reticulans in my stories. But as far as the mantids go, I think of them like in this Jiminy Cricket kind of way. Like, okay. Jiminy Cricket. So they're actually like kind of good and they kind of help people. It's a little bit debatable whether or not they actually do, but they think they do.
Jiminy Cricket was the conduit to bringing basically human consciousness into the homunculus of Pinocchio, right? So. It's a very Gnostic tale, but he's sort of that initial spark of consciousness that invites a bigger spark. So I think that's a great analogy for the mantids kind of directing that. And it made me think as you were talking too, in this world that you've created, are there good guys and bad guys, or is everyone just different shades of gray?
The reptilians are kind of bad. The grays are kind of bad, not totally bad. The mantids are sort of good. I've also got, not on my website yet, but I'm doing a series right now about the Palladians, the Space Brothers, and they're bad. They're like totally assholes. They've been really cracking me up. I've enjoyed painting about them. They're sort of like, they're like all influencers. They all work online, but
are these the Paul brothers?
They're all like hot and they all kind of look down on regular people. Or humans, and they're way more productive because they only sleep like 2 hours a day. They have cool technology, they have cool jumpsuits, and they just think humans are super pathetic and they're just jerks. And so in my imaginary world, there was like a lot of strife that happened when they landed back in ancient times, which was actually just 42 years ago. They landed in the southwestern bellows, but then they were banished and they now live on this little island. And they were banished because they were assholes. And there was like a little war that was fought. But as far as the grays go in my imaginary world, they're more like, they're really elusive and they live like in caves and stuff. They live in their spaceships. They're really scary. They steal people's dreams.
Because they can't have any of their own?
Yeah, they can't have any of their own. And I really, I was kind of like taking from like the actual UFOlogy a little bit that I've read, where, you know, one of the theories is they want to like start inbreeding themselves into the human population through like abductions and impregnations and stuff like that. So they don't quite do that in my stories, but they want to gain something that they've lost, which would be like some sort of like, I don't want to say humanity because they're aliens, so they're not human, but they're, you know, their animal nature. They want to regain some of that. So they're trying to regain it through humans. They don't dream. They don't, if they die, they're like reborn right away on this weird mothership that's in my imagination. I call it the Quartz Embassy.
So they just kind of respawn immediately?
Yeah, they're respawn, and they're respawn with their cool robe on already. They're born with a robe. There is one alien that makes all the robes, though, and that alien is called the Royal Clothier.
How much of this have you, like, do you have an entire storyline about the Royal Clothier and where they come from and what their aspirations and ambitions are?
No, I just know that there is the Royal Clothier, and that person, it takes them 200 years to make a robe.
Why not 500? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a really elaborate robe, I don't see why not. Yeah. Or a really tall person, it would take them probably twice as long.
I see a little bit of references to like Egyptian lore. There was one where they were in the canoe, which I love. That's might be one of my favorite ones, where they're in the canoe and you've got like Sebek with a crocodile face, or at least something that refers to that. And you've got like a sarcophagus. Like, how much do you know / care about like ancient Egyptian stuff? Is it aesthetic mostly, or are you like really into it?
I like it quite a lot. I think it's really cool. In Portland, they had this right around the time this painting and that other painting that you were referring to was painted. I had just gone to see an Egyptian exhibit at OMSI, which is the Oregon Institute of Science and Industry, I think. Oregon Museum of Science and Industry. They had a replica of King Tut's tomb there, and it was amazing. And I love, I just love all of that Egyptian stuff. I mean, like sweet art, cool, weird religious magic, some of the very first, like, you know, like Egyptian magic is a thing that people still are into. They still like, some people still like practice that, like the Golden Dawn, where like all those, you know, people in the 1800s were like obsessed with Egypt and like the Egyptian mysteries and like all that kind of stuff. I think it's pretty far out.
Yeah, Cagliostro, I think, was into like the Egyptian rites, and then that made its way into French Freemasonry, which then made its way into the Rites of Memphis Misraim, which are the one, those are the ones when people are like, oh, they're like a super high degree Mason, right? Like normal Masonry, Scottish Rite goes up to like 32 or 33, but the Memphis Misraim goes up to like 99. Those are the ones where they're like, you know, my uncle's like a super high ranking Mason. That's always what I think. It's probably not what they're talking about, but yeah, those are the ones that went all the way up into like almost the triple digits. I think that like, even if you get into those groups, they're like, well, it goes way beyond 99, man. It goes up to like 130.
Wow. I wonder what the apron looks like when you get,
but that's where degree. The apron, I believe, also came from, was from like the Egypt. Egyptian rites.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and that's cool.
There's I don't know how much, like, are you familiar with Manly Palmer Hall's work at all?
He's like an, I guess you would say, sort of a new age, early, but I don't want to say it like in a, some people take the term new age to be, maybe new thought would be more of like, it's like a new thought author, right?
Yeah, he was, I think, 1920s, I think, is when he started getting his things together.
Wrote The Sacred Flame or something like
this. Initiates of the Flame.
Initiates of the Flame.
The New Destiny, New Destiny of Atlantis, I think is the name of it. Secret Teachings of All Ages.
Goes
on. He wrote so damn many of them. But the reason I was bringing him up is that it's, I can see some of the, I guess, like partial influence, but that was also just because that was New Age. He was right on the very edge of, like, I guess, the late 1800s going into the early 1900s. And in my mind, he's like the entry point for a lot of Americans into occult topics. He's kind of the one that made it easy for the bumpkins like me to understand without having to go through all of the, Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn rituals and understand all the secrets. He would just be like, hey, here's the secrets. And then, you know, he might not have made a lot of friends during that process.
Yeah, I haven't actually read any of his books, but I'm sure one day.
So this is the Mantis guy again. And are humans good or bad, or are they just humans in your
world? They're just humans. There's witches and wizards and all different types of people. People are generally pretty gray, you know. There's good characters, bad characters. The grays are definitely gray, leaning towards bad. The reptilians are all the way bad.
Is this is she a shape-shifting reptilian?
Yeah, I think so. That was like a little commission piece that somebody asked me for. So sometimes I do those without, you know, so I'm like, okay, cool.
They don't have to necessarily fit into the world exactly.
That one's actually a commission too. So those don't quite fit into the world. I had had another.
Oh, that's so cool, man.
I had another story that I kind of came up with based on that. And somebody saw something from my sketchbook and they were like, hey, man, could you paint this? So I was like, okay.
Will you only do that if, like, you really like the idea that they pitch you?
I don't do it very often because doing commissions is very stressful. Mm-hmm. I take so long to make a painting. I only make like 15, maybe a year, 14 or 15. So, if it's like somebody who's bought a painting before and they want another one, or they bought more than one painting, then I'll be like, okay, cool. I really appreciate them supporting me in that way. So I'm kind of just like, okay, you know, you bought a couple paintings. Okay, whatever you want. Like, I really appreciate it. So
now that you've explained some of the world where the aliens like can't dream and they steal dreams, is this an alien stealing a dream, or is this like
that's an alien astral projecting out of a human?
How does that work?
I don't know. it just happens. You know, like it's kind of like if we were to astral project out of our body, we would probably have a representation of ourselves that would come out. But if you're an alien who's possessed the body of a human, then your astral projected body would still be your original incorporeal alien body.
I don't know how much you get into like the astral projection stuff. This little cord that you've drawn there that's connecting him there in like say Rosicrucianism, that would be called like the silver cord, and that could get severed at some point.
When I was a little kid, I went to the library and checked out a book about astral projection, and I practiced like the exercises every single day for a very long time, with various results. I was really, really into that as a kid. I had one really major out of body experience. You know, I was at outdoor school when I was a kid. It was very trippy.
You said you were into it when you were a kid. Do you have any desire to astral project now? Have you like grown out of it? Do you just not have time?
Probably not have time, you know? Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm still interested in it. I'm still interested in magic in other ways too. But yeah, astral projection, remote viewing, things like that, I do find pretty fascinating still.
Do you do any, like, I noticed on your feed you've got a bunch of tarot cards and like pictures and stuff. Do you do that actively to like direct your day or anything?
Yeah, I took a few tarot classes. I'll give readings to friends. I'll usually pick a card every day, or focus on a card that I want to have happen for that day. So I'll intentionally like choose to do that. I also use tarot as like a creative prompt too. Like if I'm, I guess that could be one of the, that question you were asking earlier about writer's block.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I do when I'm creating a series of paintings that has a major storyline is I have a specific spread that I use for creating the story. So like the spread will be like protagonist, setting, conflict, emotion, moral, you know, something like that. So that I can start generating a story based on a spread. Maybe I won't completely go with it, but it kind of gets my mind going in a direction that maybe I, you know, hadn't thought of before. So yeah,
Good.
Oh, sorry.
I was going to ask if you had a specific tarot deck that you prefer.
Yeah, the Rider-Waite deck for sure. It's right here next to me. It's like, here, I can show you. It's very beat up.
Yeah, it's very worn.
Yeah, I love this thing.
Do you bring that everywhere with you?
Not everywhere, no.
What about your... I was going to ask you this before. Like, when I said, you know, is it a fleeting thought? Like, will you be able to remember, like, an idea you had? What do you do if you don't have, like, a sketch pad and like, a pencil on you for whatever reason? Like, and an idea comes to you?
I mean, usually I do have a sketchbook with me at all times. But, I mean... usually I'll just be like, okay, cool. That's a good idea. I'll draw that later. And then whenever I have a very good memory for some reason, it's weird being dyslexic, but having a good memory, I don't ever, forget, like visual ideas.
Is this a reptilian or what is this guy?
What did I call him? The Lorga. That was more of just like a demon that was an oracle, and that's the little version of the story they were going to ask some advice of the Lorga.
I love that they bring him a strawberry rhubarb pie. That's the coolest thing to give an oracle monster.
Yeah, it likes pie. And then that's Haxum Forehand in there. He's a major reoccurring character. He's a crystal wizard. He's super new age. He had some alcohol issues that he had overcome. But you know, for the most part, he's a really great guy. He travels around and like he uses crystals as his main, he heals people with crystals.
I saw him healing a gray in an earlier one. Is he like in league with the grays, or does he have something worked out with them?
He actually is friends with the grays. There aren't very many that are friends with the grays. That gray's name was Solirium, which is Miralax backwards, which is what I give my cat when it gets constipated. But its name is it's Solirium. And Haxum Forehand encountered that gray in the desert, and it had been shot by some bandits. It was just that Solirium is a cactus theologian and a force field expert, but a force field chief, I'm sorry. And for whatever reason, his force field didn't work and he got shot, and Haxum healed the gray, and they became friends. And Haxum taught the alien taught Haxum all about force fields, and Haxum taught the gray all about friendship.
Have you ever considered like turning this into an actual, I mean, I know, you know, writing, you said, is kind of like a pain, but like writing all this into a narrative with like the images, illustrations.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of working on that right now. So it's something that's kind of happening. I've got a publisher in France I've been talking with. So we'll see. You know, part of it, they want to put it out. So I'm going to let them kind of guide the effort a little bit. But yeah, I would love to put out a book or something like that.
I mean, the images are so cool, but hearing you tell the stories behind everything just makes it like 10 times as cool.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. It's,
When I saw this one, I mean, I'm biased, but all I could think of was Bohemian Grove. Is that?
Yeah, definitely.
What are your thoughts on Bohemian Grove?
I first heard about Bohemian Grove like a little over 20 years ago, but I was like in a college. I did a political science degree at the U of O, and I had this. It was like back before you could find all this stuff on the internet. I had this teacher telling me about, you know, he was really into conspiracies and stuff. And he was telling us all about Bohemian Grove. And I was just like, whoa, that is far out.
It doesn't sound real. And then you read about how real it is. And that was one of my biggest ones, too, was like, are you telling me that these guys on TV that are talking about being, you know, like, God-fearing Christians and trying to I don't have a religious leaning one way or the other, but to say one thing and be like, you know, you can't even wear white after Labor Day and or I'll be offended, and then it's like, and I'm gonna go and sacrifice this effigy to a pagan god. It was like this weird, like, complete breakdown of what I assumed was reality. I don't know, man, that's like my go-to.
Yeah, definitely Bohemian Grove is fascinating to me. And also, I thought I've never been there, obviously. I wouldn't be allowed, but I've heard that, you know, like presidents and officials who you would not picture being friends would, you know, be there together at the Grove, you know, just all kinds of different people who you would be like, oh, really, you guys all go to this.
My favorite analogy for that, if you've never heard of Jordan Maxwell, highly recommend just like devouring everything he's ever put out. But Jordan Maxwell has this amazing talk. He does a lot with like wordplay, but one of my favorite ones is he's talking about lawyers in a courtroom. And if you imagine like two basketball players on the court, and they might be, you know, arch enemies, you know, like this big rivalry that's been going on for 20 years.
Yeah.
But after the game, let's say that like everyone that was at that game, the audience, the players, the refs, they all go to like a bar somewhere, and all the basketball players go into the VIP section. Who do you think that they'd have more ease sharing a beer with? Their arch rival of 20 years or some random bumpkin fan that like might even be on their side? It's like they would still hang out with like their quote unquote enemies, because they're their peers, right? They're
all basketball players.
Right. And he would say that the same thing is with lawyers, is that after the big court case, the two lawyers are going to have a drink with each other because they were just in the court, just volleying that ball back and forth. And like, they're both on the game and they love to just be in the game, and they can bond over being players in the game and everyone else is a spectator. So two players will always have more in common than a player and a spectator would ever have. So anyway, that's when I see Bohemian Grove and it's like, dog, you know, cats and dogs living together, pure chaos. But really, it's just like, no, two rich guys living together.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. You're powerful and I'm powerful. Let's hang out at this place and worship Moloch the owl.
Skinny dip.
Yeah. 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 Let's kill a hooker too. All the rumors or whatever.
Cremation of care. Yeah, that's
the cremation of care. Yeah, that's what it's called. Yeah, I played in punk bands when I was in college, and we had a song about the Bohemian Grove.
What was it called? Was it just called Bohemian
Grove? I think it was called Bohemian Grove, yeah.
Right on the nose. I like it. So I want to, I mean, you've got so much art here. I'm not going to go through every single one. When we first started, though, you mentioned that you're kind of working in like batches of nine that tell a story, and I couldn't help but notice these most recent nine.
So all the new ones. Those were all in a Bigfoot series called The Primordial Conjunction. Apparently, I've never seen Shrek, but I've been told that my storyline is identical to the storyline of Shrek with that. I don't know if that's cool or not, but, you know,
that's just how it worked out. Well, I don't remember Shrek getting an amulet and transforming into a human, but...
Yeah. So it's about this Sasquatch named Applebear Stonetree who he sees these Bigfoot hunters in the forest, and he falls in love with this one... Bigfoot hunter because she smells horrible, and he's just like, oh my god, I love her. So he goes to the aliens. Oh, spoiler alert, in my weird story, Bigfoot is what an alien gray used to be before they transcended, and like they're to were to like primates to us are what Sasquatch is to an alien gray.
Okay.
So anyway, like
the missing link between humans and grays, kind of.
Well, no, we're not even related to grays. That's just like that's what grays were in their ancient past, as they were Sasquatch. So but that's just in my story. But anyway, so Applebear Stonetree acquires this shape-shifting amulet from a gray who is down to help him with his love quest. So he transforms into this hot guy, and then he goes back to group in his human form, and then he meets this woman, and they fall madly in love. They get married the next day. And then he decides to tell her that, yo, now that we're married, I have to tell you something. I'm actually a Sasquatch posing as a hot stud. And she's like, oh, dang, that doesn't bother me at all. And then he gets shot and one of the Bigfoot hunters sees the Bigfoot that he's turned into, and she accidentally shoots Clorinda Moondew. That's her name. That's the love interest name. Instead, he goes totally berserk. But then something magical happens, and it turns out that his love interest was actually also a Sasquatch posing as a human and hopes to find love. So she was tagging along with a couple of Sasquatch hunters, hoping that she could find a Sasquatch because they're so elusive. They have a hard time finding each other. So in the end, they open a portal to the primordial realm, and they go back in time and lay some Sasquatch eggs.
Oh, that's a new one for me. So these Sasquatch actually lay eggs.
Yeah. They lay eggs and they're able to communicate with the fairy, with the creatures of the fairy realm. They're not okay, fairies yeah, though, but they're on good terms with the fairy folk.
What's the little skeleton dude that has like a tree stump and duck legs?
Yeah, he's of the Unseelie court. He's like a bad fairy.
All fairies could potentially be bad fairies. I've read some horrible things about fairies.
Yeah, that fairy is he's kind of bad. Maybe a little bit of a trickster kind of guy.
So I've got another segment here that I think is a good segue, especially talking about fairies and dinosaurs and Bigfoot. So let's just run into it.
Hey, conspiracy buffs, I double dare you to take some PCP, the Paranormal Conspiracy Probe. On your marks, get set, and go!
So this is just real casual. I'm just going to ask you on a rating from 0 to 10. 0 meaning like you don't believe in something at all, and 10 meaning like you're 100% on board with it. I just want to get a temperature check on a bunch of random topics.
I can't preface it with any disclaimer or anything.
If you want to, I would just give it like a 5 or a 6 and we'll revisit it. So you don't have to feel like ultra committed to any of these numbers. Like we'll revisit all these. This is what's going to drive the last like 10, 15 minutes of us talking.
Okay. Right?
So Bigfoot 0 to 10, like how 10. Real is he? 100% 10. The sure. Grays.
10.
Reptilians.
10.
Dinosaurs.
10.
Dragons.
10.
Man, where can I get some nines or eights at? Okay, I like this so far. Let's direct it a little bit. Humans have stepped foot on the moon.
10.
The moon landing footage that was shown in the 60s was real.
It was in the James Bond movie. I do think that was real. And I was going to say that it was also in that James. So I guess it was real. Sorry, delete that last part that I said.
The one that got aired on television, you think was the actual moon landing footage?
Yeah, why not?
Okay. Magic is real.
Yes, 10.
Aleister Crowley successfully summoned a demon.
9.
How possible, 0 to 10, do you think it would be for like an atheist to just go and buy like the top 5 books on how to summon a demon on Amazon and then successfully summon a demon?
I don't know. It really depends on the person. That's a tough question. I would say a pretty low number, like a 3.
What do you think of Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole assassin of JFK? 0 to 10.
0.
Do you think, we'll get back into that. JFK is one of my favorite topics, so we'll get into that. Celebrity clones. Like, for example, people would say like Jamie Foxx is no longer Jamie Foxx. It's now a clone of Jamie Foxx. And then he came out with a movie about being a clone. How real do you think celebrity clones are right now?
I don't know if I have enough information about that. I don't know anything about celebrity.
We don't have clones. To name anyone in particular. Have you not heard about celebrity clones?
I haven't
in general?
Heard of any celebrity. I don't know anything about celebrities.
So
like that's one black hole in my knowledge.
You're missing out
about,
so much. You're going to be on your deathbed and you're going to be like, I wish I knew more about celebrities.
When people talk about pop culture and stuff, I have no idea what they're talking about ever.
So, I mean, look, I want to transition away from the.
But that's
the,
awesome. The, I want to questions. Learn more about the clones.
Well,
cool.
One of them is the ones that I don't really like as much, but like the Jamie Foxx is a big one. Usually when a celebrity gets like really sick and then they bounce back, everyone will, and I say everyone in a very flippant way, but a lot of the conspiracy community is like, you know, that's not the real one. He's fake now. The biggest example is probably Britney Spears, where a lot of people assume that she's either programmed or she's got a body double or there's legitimately like real clones and they just cloned her so they could always have this, you know, ready to go to work sort of, you know, product model they could just put up on stage. I don't necessarily put a lot of credit into a lot of them, but it is a very persistent topic that I find interesting.
That's a pretty cool idea. I mean, at the same time though, I did see on Instagram Britney dancing with some knives and it seems pretty Britney though, you know, that seems like something that she would do. I don't know if that was like seems like a clone sort of thing, but I don't know that much about Britney, so I just, you know, it didn't seem like too crazy. I was like, yeah, you know, that's cool.
What is your media consumption like?
my media consumption is like 90% fantasy novels. Like I listen to a lot of fantasy novels. I'll listen to the news while I'm painting on a podcast. We usually listen to like the BBC or maybe something from around here. I don't really watch it's kind of rare. Like if I'm on vacation, my girlfriend and I will like watch some movies or something, but sometimes I'll watch Netflix while I'm painting. But for the most part, I listen to books and I listen to music and stuff.
Do you have any like movies or TV shows that you remember from your youth that have directed your view on art or anything? Like you see The Exorcist or you see like, you know, Close Encounters?
All of those. Yeah. I mean, I only watch like that kind of stuff. I mean, The X-Files, like Sightings. Sightings was a big one. That show was kind of spooky sometimes. Unsolved Mysteries. I would say mainly The X-Files when I was a kid, as far as like alien stuff goes. But I guess the one thing that really did it was the Mysteries of the Unknown books. I was always more into books than watching stuff. So,
those? Mysteries of the Unknown, was that the one that National Geographic put out?
It's a Time Life series, and they're all really pretty high quality. Oh, wait, I even have one still. I have one on witchcraft. But these things were...
Oh my God, I 100% had some of those, man. Not that one.
I had... Wow. My stepdad owned a lot of these. My real dad owned a lot of these. So whenever I would go over to his house, I would, I'd flip through those and I would learn about all kinds of stuff. And I was pretty young when I started reading them. I was like, whoa, werewolves? You can turn into a werewolf by doing that? That's amazing. When I grow up, I want to be a werewolf.
That, man, you just gave me a huge hit of nostalgia on that one, because I remember that exact... I haven't seen one of those in like decades, but I remember one was about the Bermuda Triangle, and it also had an article on spontaneous combustion. I remember eight or nine, and I just remember thinking, you're telling me that there's people just bursting into flames randomly all over the place, and I haven't seen this on the news yet.
And like, that could happen to me.
Yeah, dude, is this going to happen to me? Like, what was going on here? It's weird how like the spontaneous combustions kind of died out after they introduced like flame retardant clothing and, you know, safety stuff.
Yeah, people stopped smoking as much.
Yeah, stop smoking in the car and flicking it on them and then going over the flames. Uh-huh. So, I wanted to ask about the JFK one. Because you said zero that Lee Harvey Oswald. I mean, that's just a placeholder question to figure out how much you actually care about it. So
I don't really know that much about it. I mean, I don't think I'm the most informed person to be like having a passionate argument in that way.
That it just stop seems anyone like with passionate arguments, though.
Yeah, it just doesn't really seem like. One person could, you know, put together an operation like that, you know, just on what little I know. It seems like a challenging little project to put together, to like murder a president. You know, it seems like you would want to have some allies and you'd want to maybe be put up to it. I don't know. I read the Stephen King book. It was a date. The date JFK was assassinated. I can't remember what the actual date was.
But you're putting me on the spot. November 3rd, 1963, I think. 11/3/93, is that the name of it?
Yeah. It was a time travel book. It's pretty cool.
I did not read the book. I did see the TV show with James Franco, though.
Yeah, I haven't seen the show, but yeah, that was pretty fascinating. I think his whole thing was that he acted alone in Stephen King's book. I can't remember, but yeah, what's your ideas on it? I mean, I do find it fascinating, but
I've got wild thoughts on it, to be honest. I'm somewhere, I mean, just like you, I'm not an expert on the topic. And also, I feel like you could literally spend your entire life becoming an expert on the topic and still not have the right answer. But I am a huge fan of the King Kill 33 theory. Are you familiar with this?
No.
So, man, this will wrap up our conversation here a little bit. But like
Cool.
the King Kill 33 ritual, to grandly oversimplify it, is basically that the health of the kingdom reflects the health of the king. So if you've got a virulent king that's like at the top of his game and a sharp thinker and witty, then you also have the village that is kind of reflecting that. At the same time, if you've got a sickly leader that's like on his deathbed, then it's also like your village is sickly and might be on its deathbed. And likewise, if you've got a corrupt leader, then it might mean that your city's corrupt. So this kind of acting as the leader is almost like the head of the body in a lot of ways. So King Kill 33 ritual states that you can control that power. So if the king is sickly and you kill the king, then whoever inherits that energy might also be sickly. So I'm oversimplifying this, but it means that you want to take the king out at his height, at the peak of his energy, because whoever you replace the king with gets to inherit that high amount of like real quality energy, right? So you don't just like bump the old guy on his way out and replace him with a new guy because there's not a huge transfer there. So the King Kill 33 ritual, which not mine by any means. It's proposed by this guy named James Shelby Downard, who is dead now, a long time ago. But basically, that the where it took place in Dealey Plaza, the arrangement of where people were standing, the time of day that it happened, like he passed under some sort of pagan. I don't know all the little intricate details, but that he was taken out in a very ritualistic, magical way in order to transfer that energy from one to the next being LBJ essentially. So that's one of my favorite theories. There's a lot of other cool ones. One of them is that he was killed by a curse from I can't
What?
remember his name, the president of Haiti, because JFK he revoked international aid that we were giving to Haiti, and the president of Haiti at the time, I'm flaking on his name, he basically put out a curse on JFK, and after JFK was taken out, he claimed that it was his curse that was what really happened. And to make this just a little bit more sweet, this guy named George de Morenschild, who if you go into the JFK research and stuff, or
That
even
name
in Stephen
sounds
King's book,
very familiar.
well, he
Yeah.
was in the book. He was the one that basically became Lee's friend when Lee moved to either Dallas or Fort Worth. Because de Morenschild, he had a Russian history, and basically anytime
Friends with
someone
the
moved,
wife, too, right?
exactly. Oh, so not only friends with the wife, he also knew Jackie Kennedy when she was just a girl. Not just did he know, and this is all real, that I'm not just
Oh,
like coming up
wow.
with random. So he knew Jackie Ken or Jackie Kennedy, Bouvier, or was her maiden name, knew her as a girl. He literally wrote in one of his memoirs that she used to sit on his knee as he would tell stories. So like her as a little girl, he knew JFK, he knew JFK's wife Marina, and he was in Haiti in Port-au-Prince when JFK got killed, and he wrote in his memoirs that as soon as he heard the president was dead, that he knew it was Lee Harvey Oswald. So you got this guy that's like connected to Haiti, connected to JFK, connected to Jackie, connected to Lee, connected to Marina, connected to CIA. Anyways, the theories
Wow.
don't stop, man. Like every time I pull up one little leaf, it's like there's 20 other theories under there. We're not even talking about the guy that has the weird eyebrows that I forgot Dan, not Danny DeVito, but someone played him in the JFK movie. I can't remember. Have you ever seen the JFK movie? So there's a weirdo that like shaves his eyebrows off and like draws them back on. This is based on a real person. And that guy is the one that started the Civil Air Patrol that Lee Harvey Oswald also joined while he was in New Orleans. So it's just like everything's connected. And the more I look into it, it makes me feel like JFK never had a chance. He was born to be sacrificed in a magical ritual. And it was just like, take your pick on who ended up doing it. But he was kind of like meant to fill that role. So anyways, that's my thought on it.
Wow. That's far out. Yeah. That's a rabbit hole I'd like to dive down again too.
I'd love to drop that seed, man. Maybe there's like a presidential assassination plot in your fantasy world that can play itself out.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, thank you. That's good.
Well, Mark, I want to give you another chance to just tell people where they can find your work, where the website is, if there's any like projects you got going on to look out for. This is airing early November.
Cool. Yeah. My website is www.markrogersart.com. My Instagram is @markrogersart. Right now, I just had a show in Philly at the Arch Enemy Gallery with for the High Fructose Invitational 2023, and I think that that'll still be going on when this airs. So if anybody's in Philly, I have a huge painting there at the gallery. There's a bunch of other really cool paintings there too. It's a group show. So
yeah, congratulations, by the way, man, that's huge. Thanks. That's awesome.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Jeez. Right, well, thanks for having me on, Thomas.
Yeah, man, this was fascinating. I love getting the backstory. I never would have known any of this. I mean, I just like the art, but now knowing the story, oh wait, I actually, before we go, I have to ask you about the dolphin character. I've got a good friend, Peter. Shout out Donut. What's his name?
Peter.
So what's Peter's backstory?
Peter is a dolphin human hybrid who is sort of like acting as the Palladian's coastal patrol officer, and he's kind of like like their servant, I guess. He's the only nice one to this character. This is the current story I'm working on. It's about this guy named Ballard Diffenbach, who is a cookie salesman, and he goes to the island where the Palladians live to like try to set up a cookie subscription account with them. And they are like, you are pathetic. We don't eat sugar. We're amazing. You're just disgusting for even coming here. And also, you also have to take our mentorship program. So the series is about him undergoing their brutal mentorship program, where he has to work on his brand, and he has to become more productive and more spiritual and more all of this stuff. And he probably won't survive.
But is Peter, he selling these cookies one by one, like by hand?
He's always just handing people a cookie in the banks. It just kind of cracks me up. He's like kind of creepy in that way. He's like, here, have a cookie.
So anyway, yeah, I wanted to shout out to Donut because he loves dolphins. And when I saw this, are you familiar with John C. Lilly's work at all?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely was into that. There's a shark human hybrid in this story too, who's Dieter. So it's Peter and Dieter, the dolphin and the shark. But yeah, John Lilly's a pretty fascinating guy.
Well, man, thanks again so much for coming on, for talking with me. I had a great time. I hope you did too. And hey, maybe sometime fun. In the future, we can get back on and talk, just geek out about John C. Lilly and a bunch of other cool people.
Okay, cool. How fun.
All right. Thanks again, Mark. And I'll leave everyone on a commercial for my latest comic. By the time you're seeing this, it probably already would have dropped unless you're on Patreon, in which case, go support it. Go buy a copy. And then I'll talk to you in a second, Mark, right after this awesome commercial.
Frazzle Drip Funhouse. Enter, if you dare, the world of an animatronic bear whose metallic heart beats with a thirst for justice, a hunger for revenge. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, connoisseurs of the macabre and seekers of the scandalous. Your voracious appetites for chilling narratives are about to be satiated by the heart-stopping, pulse-pounding creation of Paranoid American and Winged Sun Comics. Abandoned in the dusty corners of amusement, now awoken in the murk of wickedness perpetrated by an evil elite. And this is not your childhood fairy tale, but a macabre dance of vindication, soaked in crimson, a symphony of screams echoing in the dimly lit chambers of malevolence. Be prepared for an onslaught of ghastly gore and titillating terror. A wicked waltz through twisted hallways and blood-stained basements where only the brave dare to tread. Quake at the bear's unyielding pursuit, cackle at the sharp and sardonic one-liners, shudder at the graphic, gratuitous scenes that harken back to the glory days of B-horror flicks. Frazzle Drip Funhouse is your ticket to a thrill ride of terror. Carnival of carnage where the laughs are as loud as the screams. Uncover the truth beneath the rust and the blood, and remember, nothing is as it seems. Are you ready to step into the Frazzle Drip Funhouse, where the animatronic eyes are always watching and vengeance is a game that everyone can play? Get your backer exclusive cover on Indiegogo. For more information, visit ParanoidAmerican.com.